Hey, welcome to our fourth seminar. Today we're going to be discussing liberating ourselves from internalized capitalism, patriarchy and oppression, and specific tools and techniques. We also obviously wanted to mention the historic uprising that's happening at the moment in the US and express love and solidarity for everyone that's in that struggle and also in the struggle against fascism and capitalism globally. And also the world, we're all watching the massive leaps forward that are happening at the moment in abolition. It's a really incredible moment. I think that like everyone's eyes are there. And also this is something that this session is actually very relevant to as well. It's one of the topics that I find most interesting because of how the system that's inside of us and the way that that manifests, like how we overcome that is connected to all things, healthcare, education, justice. This topic's only going to be scratching the surface in the next hour and a half, but hopefully it'll be able to continue as well. We're going to put some links to organizations in the chat, and please check them out or get organized with them or donate, whatever you can. The first one is Community Action on Prison Expansion, which is a community coalition of groups fighting prison expansion in England, Wales and Scotland. The second one is the Prisoner Solidarity Network. The third one is No More Exclusions, which is a grassroots abolitionist organisation in the UK that's seeking to end the race disparity in school exclusions and bring about wider change in and beyond schools. The fourth one is United Family and Friends Campaign, which is a coalition of those affected by deaths in police, prison and psychiatric custody and supports others in similar situations. And the last one is National Bailout, which is a US bail fundraiser for Black mothers in the US. So the session is gonna run until 9 p.m. and the chat is there for questions. Please be nice, try and like be kind to each other. We have people that are looking at the chat on Facebook and here. And if you wanna ask questions, please do at any point. People will also be posting some clarifications for different topics. Different words and stuff like this, but always feel free to ask a question or like pitch in with a comment, and at the end there'll be an opportunity for the speakers to answer some of the questions. I'm very slow with the tech. In the first section we have Dilar Dirk. Sorry, my computer's frozen. Okay, cool. Yeah, unfroze. So in the first section, we have Dilar Dirk from the Jenny Kurdish Women's Office for Peace, which is an institution of the Kurdish women's movement in Europe, and also Irene Helene from Genealogy and Rojava Azadi Madrid Collective.
Thank you for the introduction, Hazel. Thanks everybody for joining. And I also want to start out by saluting the historic resistance of people all over the world, actually, but especially, of course, in the United States. The Kurdish freedom movement is in solidarity, especially the Kurdish women's movement is in solidarity with the Black liberation struggle. And it is something that we all need to support, and we need to acknowledge that the liberation of Black people is the liberation of everybody, and that our struggles are connected. So I also wanted to start out by saluting this historic resistance. So I'm just going to jump right in so that we have plenty of time for discussion. When it comes to the Kurdish freedom movement's analysis of the links between the individual and society and liberation in general, it's important to mention that in the eyes of the Kurdish freedom movement, oppression is not fate. So violence is not part of human nature, and domination is not something that's organically developed over the course of human history. Instead, violence is an outcome of systems of oppression. For example, patriarchy, male domination, the state as a system or structure of controlling society through violence and hegemony, and that these systems were actively created over time. So, but at the same time, people have always resisted against them. So sometimes people have, on an individual level, resisted against injustice, against oppression. Sometimes they have come together in an together collectively, they have resisted, or sometimes they've organized on such a large scale that it amounted to a revolution. So early on, when the Kurdish freedom movement first started, it was from the start also a critique and self-critique of Kurdish society itself. For example, feudalism, class relations, the patriarchal family, they were all analyzed by the Kurdish freedom movement, especially Abdul Öcalan, in the movement's theory very early on. And I won't get into any of those details because in past sessions people have talked about them. But early on there was an understanding that if Kurdistan is going to be free, then the Kurdish people also as a society, but also as individuals, they need to liberate themselves through revolution. So we cannot expect change to come from the outside. We actively need to transform ourselves. So from the very beginning of the movement's theory and ideology, the liberation of the individual was connected to the struggle against colonialism. Actually, one of the things that Abdul Öcalan said quite early on was something along the lines of, the vast majority, or like 98% or 99% of my struggle is actually against the colonized Kurdish individual and their socialization under Turkish colonialism, or generally colonialism, through the colonization of the language, of taste. The Kurdish human being had been so assimilated or so oppressed that they were no longer themselves. Their whole identity belonged to the state. And of course, oppressed people are often taught to hate themselves, to blame themselves for their oppression. So it's not like that. In this case, it was more of a question when the Kurdistan revolution began, is like, what kind of Kurdistan is livable? What kind of Kurdistan is dignified, and how to live? Basically, how to live and what to do and where do we start were among the urgent questions at the time. But it's also a question about how do we become ourselves? How do we liberate Kurdish identity, which is not just like a fixed identity, but like a historical, let's say, phenomenon? How do we liberate peoples from definitions of the state? How do we liberate women from patriarchal definitions of life? So quite early on, there was, again, in the movement's theory, the idea that revolution is not possible with the dominant violent men. And also it's not possible with the enslaved woman, because we need new social relations that are based on freedom if we want sustainable egalitarian communities. So for liberation, the struggle against the state was not enough. There needed to be an internal transformation as well. For there to be revolutionary personalities, each individual had to start within themselves. So when we speak about decolonization, we don't speak in the abstract. We talk about very concrete things, very concrete practices of getting rid of the capitalist system, getting rid of liberalism. And I will explain a bit more on that. But basically this, how do we liberate ourselves on one hand from very oppressive structures in society, such as, for example, religious conservatism, which especially affects women, but on the other hand, also capitalism's way of isolating human beings into pockets of loneliness, losing touch of society. So in this sense, the struggle against assimilation, against colonialism, against state violence, and I mean, I'm sure many people here are following what's going on in Kurdistan. It also meant protecting our very own selves, not just as a society, but also individuals from being swallowed by the system. So last week, there was a session on the Kurdish women's movement, especially, and I just want to say a few things on that. That actually the autonomous women's structures that have developed in the movement since the 1990s especially were in a way also a critique and self-critique of Kurdish society. Also the youth movement, so youth and the women are seen in the current paradigm of the Kurdish freedom movement as the guarantee for social transformation. They are the opposite in that sense of what the male dominated system based on power and domination represents: social control, tradition, conservatism, right? The youth and the women, and especially young women, are therefore able to be at the forefront of social transformation, because if they are free, then everybody gets free. This also means to break with the idea that society is men, because whenever we say society is not ready, what we actually mean is that the old men in the society are not ready for change. So we need to redefine society in this way as well. One of the sentences that is often used in the Kurdish freedom movement is a quote by Abdullah Öcalan, which is to analyze history in the moment and society in the individual. So, for example, when we fight against violence against women in the Kurdish community, we acknowledge that Kurdish men too are brutalized in a gendered way, actually, by the patriarchal state. While they themselves, the men, are taking out their rage on women and on children, on each other, they reproduce and also represent the male-dominated system. So when we look at the society's problems, when we look at all the issues that we experience in our communities, we need to understand them as products of systems of oppression. It's not the men who are inherently evil, or groups of people who have essential characteristics, but it's, we need to think about austerity. We need to think about how austerity produces violence against women, for example. So one way in which we can overcome these things is actually through practices of love and care inside of our own social movements and in our communities. And that is fundamentally based on the idea that change is possible. It might sound very simple, but it's actually, we need to think about that a bit more closely. Because the Kurdish freedom movement and its ideology, especially the women's movement ideology, is a fundamentally hopeful one. And what does that mean? It means that in a society where we, as the recent events have shown, can't rely on the state, on the police, the family, for justice, for protection. Of course, now more and more people are talking very seriously about abolitionism, for example. Then you must fundamentally believe that society or communities can actually solve their own problems in alternative ways. So that's why, like, any effort for social change, for system change, right? More and more people are also talking about how reforms are not good enough in a system that is so violent and so oppressive and so exploitative. The whole system was designed in a way that is oppressive towards certain communities or groups of people, parts of the world. Then we need to change that system, but we need to have system change that has different principles of organizing, that has different social relations. So in this way, we must find the connections also between the problems experienced by individuals then and also social problems. So in a world full of fascism, of violence against women, ecocide, colonialism, we don't have the luxury actually to focus on single issues, to pick out the issues that we like, but we need to see struggles and the links between them. So when we speak about women's autonomy, for example, as some of you may know, the Kurdish women's movement is organized as an autonomous system, starting from the communes to the assemblies to a women's confederal system that has its own decision-making mechanisms and strategies. We don't see women's autonomy as an end as such. Of course, we really like and appreciate women-only spaces, but they have a purpose. They are not just for us to have a safe space for ourselves. They are sites of strategizing on how we can change society. So we need to be in both spheres, both inside society as well as have our autonomous spaces. And I'll explain why. It's because we cannot expect change to happen in society by simply separating ourselves. and creates comfortable havens where we all agree with each other. And this is a phenomenon, I think Arin will talk about this a bit more later, that many social movements experience today. It's, for example, feministic to feminist, anarchist to anarchist, and so on and so on. But how much do we actually impact society? How much are we, can we excite our parents with our ideas? Or do we talk between the generations, for example? Or do we only just seek comfort with people who already agree with us? Because that's not how we can change society, right? So we need to do the actual work of engaging with communities if we really want change. But that means we also must really believe that a world without violence is possible, that we can abolish rape culture, that we can abolish racism, and that we will really live in a world without injustice. I'm going to wrap up in a second. I can see the warning coming. But basically, we need to denormalize forms of violence and oppression. And for that, we need to do the work in the sense that we can't just say it's not our job to educate the man. It is actually our job. It is our mission to do that. Because who is going to change the man? We can't just be at the mercy of some men doing the work of becoming feminist and educating others. No, we have to actively play a role in being the change that we want to see. And that means that our hope is not a passive observing stance, but it involves active organization. So through organizedness, actually, that's where our hope in change in society comes from, that we can create more and more people who are freedom loving and who organize together for social change. So in this sense, just to repeat that, that we believe that actually we can abolish violence in society, but for that we need to actively organize. And when we speak of that, of course, the question of friendship is very important as well. And I think this is something that we can speak about later. But in general, what we see today in Kurdish society is that as a result of decades of struggle, we have new concepts of relating to each other. For example, there are many people, couples, married couples, who in the past, I mean, still today, marriage is a very patriarchal and oppressive phenomenon in Kurdish society anywhere in the world. But now we have people who are married to each other in the movement, and they refer to each other as hevel, as comrade or as friend. They raise kids today with different concepts of what a woman can be, what is it capable of. So even when we speak about gender relations, we are redefining what does it mean to be a person, and how is our own social transformation, our own individual transformation related. So if I believe I can change, if I believe I can overcome my anxieties, it means I believe also other people can change. And that means that we can actually change the world. But that requires organization, and it requires principles like women's autonomy. But as I said, women's autonomy is not an end as such. It is a means by which we believe that really our ultimate goal is a free society, and that we can do that. I wanted to say a few more things, but we can talk about them later in the discussion. I'll stop here now.
Oh, thank you so much. We're gonna continue anyway, discussing these things. And there's a few questions. Also, Arin Helene is going to join us as well for this next part with Dilla. When I ask the questions, also, like, people who are observing, who are participating, please also, if you feel like it, write something in the chat or on the Facebook comments about how you feel about this as well. You know, I think this is really an opportunity for collective learning. So please also say something if you can. So the first question for Arin and Dilla is, how do liberalism and individualism affect our ability to love and care for each other?
Hello, everyone. My name is Arin. I want to apologize from the beginning because my English maybe is not the best. So I'm going to read more or less what I was thinking about these questions. So about the first question, I think we have to think, and I really believe that love and care are basic human needs. So because like every need that a human have, power groups over the century had been trying to take disabilities away from us and try to supply them with different ideologies with the objective of control. And I think it's really important that we analyze the history. And for this, I want to put some examples. For example, in the time of the big religions, the first idea was that God is love, and there is not a greater love than God, no? So everything was around the idea of God. And in the next step, when God died in the Occidental or European mindset, was replaced by the modern state. And the modern state is telling you, I will take care of you, don't worry, I will provide you everything. And in the last step that we are right now, in this liberalism and postmodernism step, is the system is telling us we can take care and love ourselves alone. We don't need anyone. And I think this is like a contradiction in itself. But because I believe that love and care are basic human needs, humans always have been found in ways to love and care of each other. And this is a basic role that had been playing women. And this is really important point, because women have been reproducing love and care in a free and unrecognized way for 100 years. And now that the role of the woman is changing, the people do not know how to reproduce love and care. And this is leading us to a depressive and loneliness society and individuals. So with this, I don't want to say that a woman should continue being the only one that reproduces love and care, but I really believe that we should look at the women, especially our mothers and grandmothers, to learn how they had been reproduced love and care, and trying to find mechanisms that can reproduce this basic need among all the society in an equal way. This is like a really important aim that we should try to reach, because as I said, this is a basic need. In my experience with the Hevels and also with the families of the movement, I learned that like a new old ways of loving and caring, the community ties of the societies in Middle East and the culture of Hevelty among the comrades, they create a real strong ties between the people. And this is really, really important, because I learned it that I can feel a really deep love and admiration for Hevels, for families that I know my real families, for say in some way. And this make me learn that I can put my needs, I can put the need that I have for love and care in a different way, that I don't have to put all of this need in my closest family, or I don't need to put this to put it in a romantic relationship, but that it is possible other ways to relation it with each other. And this is what I learned it also, it is only possible through a communalized relationship or a communalized mechanism. More or less is what I want to say, I think.
Dilla, would you like to add anything on this question?
I think Keval Adin put it very beautifully, that ideas about love that have been so shaped by possession, by control, by belonging to one person or one place, and they can be liberated if we find new ways of relating to each other. And again, I think this has to do with the idea of hope. If we really think that we can live more beautifully with each other, then we have to, I'm just seeing somebody's asking about the concept of Hevelty. Maybe I could just say that it means friend. Heval is a friend. Hevelty is friendship, but in the Kurdish freedom movement, it also refers to a comrade. But that is also very much linked to, it's not just somebody that you enjoy spending time with, it's somebody that you are supporting because you walk on the same way. So re hevalti, re means way or path or road. You walk together on the path of revolution because you have a shared goal. But in order to be able to walk on that same road, you need to support each other. And for that, actually, things like being able to criticize each other, being able to uplift each other, being able to be there for each other. And of course, this concept developed especially in the revolutionary struggle, where people actually died for each other as well. So it's connected to sacrifice as well. So sacrifice, in a way, again, is something that is often attributed to women, that women should sacrifice themselves. But so what kind of beautiful ways of being there for each other, for overcoming the selfishness that individualism, liberalism are imposing on us? How can we find new ways of being hevas to each other? So again, this can also be between people who are in the same family. But again, it's, as Heval Alin has put it, it develops in the revolutionary context, in the way, to the extent to which you organize together, the ways in which you base your relationship on ideals and principles, such as no exploitation, no domination, no hierarchy. That's how you can beautify your friendships as well, so that they can mean more than just having fun together, but actually have a common meaning, a purpose together.
So in a moment, we're going to need to move on to the next part, but I thought it would also be good to say something very briefly about the culture of exclusion that's present in the movement. We kind of covered this concept of Hevelty and also how this links into criticism, which we'll also come on to more later, and about this fundamental trust between comrades, between people who are like side by side with you in struggle. But also, yeah, I don't know, maybe if you could just very, very briefly say something about the sort of, if we were stuck together and actually we couldn't exclude people, then what would happen? Like how would this change the struggle that we have if we didn't have the option of excluding people and instead we had only the option to transform people, which is also of course like linked to the prison system and abolition as well. But we only have maybe a minute, so we can then move on. If Dila or Irene, you want to say something?
Well, Irene, do you want to respond to that?
Kerem can.
Oh, I mean, maybe this is something that we can address later with our other friends as well. But I think, again, if we don't believe that the state, the police, the family can protect us, we need to find ways of doing justice and accountability and social harmony, peace in our own communities. This is why, as the Kurdish people, as the Kurdish movement, we cannot just exclude people that we don't like. Of course, sometimes somebody goes too far and you don't want them around. But basically, we need to rehabilitate, because our people are the only people that we have. Our social movements are all that we have. So whenever somebody does something that we don't like, instead of excluding them, we can find ways of holding them accountable, of criticizing them in a way that changes their behavior and in a way that solves solutions. Because if we say somebody is violent actually because of other things that are happening in their life, because of, let's say, poverty or many other things, right? Then we need to find solutions to why is that person a violent person, instead of surrendering that person to the police. So I think in this sense, this culture of exclusion in social movements is something that we need to also address if we want to talk seriously about abolitionism, for example.
Cool, thank you. Thank you both. So we're going to have a video next from Mustafa Sarakaya, who is a revolutionary who's been with the Kurdish freedom movement since 1978. He was a part of the movement's early mobilization efforts and spent time in different parts of the Middle East. He spent 20 years in a Turkish jail and was previously sentenced to death. And he's now politically active in Europe and took part in the 2018/2019 hunger strike against the isolation of Abdullah Öcalan.
Yani bu Goertunu ve Goertuna civaki a kesayat nikashi tenkirin elbette kevinin nenine.
The discussion about changing society is not new. It's an old discussion that all ideologies have something to say about, and so does the Kurdish freedom movement. We as the Kurdish freedom movement have experienced a changing society. Changing society is historical. Change starts with people. Everything keeps changing economically, technologically, so society changes as well. But if you want to make a radical change, if you want freedom, you have to start with changing yourself. And you have to have a strong connection with society. Changing society is something strategic, very important. Guide Reba Apo says, if you want to change society, you need to start with yourself. First of all, change yourself. You need to focus on what kind of life do you want to have? What do you want to change? You need to be very clear about the target changes. If you want to free yourself from old customs, you need to know what are going to replace them with. When you manage to renew yourself, when you establish the life you aim for, then you can change the society as well. You cannot postpone the way of life you want to have for after the revolution. If you aim for a certain way and you think you will lead that way after revolution, you are wrong. You should not wait for revolution. You have to live the changes straight away, no waiting. For example, the Kurdish freedom movement wants socialism, equality in every way, gender equality, democracy, environmentalism, freedom, friendship. So we are not waiting to have revolution and after revolution to establish this way of life. We live this way right now. Our life is based on those principles. When you reject the old way in order to renew yourself, you will struggle. You cannot do it at once because it's not easy to get rid of old habits and the effect of 5,000 years. PKK underlies self-criticism. It says, you need to focus on yourself, self-criticize. Just because you say I want socialism or I am socialist, it doesn't mean you are socialist. You cannot be full of yourself, proud of yourself. Do not think you are pure. Where are your customs coming from? Modernity? You need to educate yourself. Reba Apo started with himself. He first changed himself. It's 46 years since he established those principles, yet still he keeps educating himself. You need to think deep. Educating yourself is the priority. You need to gain knowledge, not only about your society and how to improve and change it, also about the world, about nature. Knowledge is very important. You need to be able to analyze in order to make changes. We are coming from a society that we want to change, but it has its effect on us. We want to create the ideal society, a socialist society, so obstacles create that society, not be ourselves, our habits and customs. The most important principles are education and criticism, constructive criticism. PKK puts the focus on renewing, as you need to get rid of the effect of your old customs and your personality, to do as you have, to be able to self-criticize and accept criticism and educate yourself. This has been one of the main principles of the PKK. The result of that has been great, and a deal of constructive change among PKK members and the PKK has changed the society. PKK gained the trust of society. We have our beliefs and values, and we will continue to make efforts in four parts of Kurdistan and beyond Kurdistan with the philosophy of Reba Öcalan and PKK members. We will continue developing.
Peştike ve keserete azad ki azadı cibuha zaten ali demokrasi u siyaset meşandine bir cibakera jiyane.
Thank you. So next we have Arin Karachok, who is an internationalist who recently returned from Rojava. And they'll be speaking a bit on Techmill and platform and other mechanisms.
Hello, that's me. Thanks, Hazel, and thank you everyone who's spoken so far. So what am I speaking about? I'm speaking about the concrete processes of technologies and platforms and how these methods of criticism and self-criticism actually work in practice and how we do them and my experiences with them as someone who came to the movement, as someone who has about 10 years odd experience of being an anarchist and in radical left politics in one type or another, and kind of how that was for me, but also like to also include in that experience like something a bit concrete about like how these processes are done. So I've made a little video with the help of a good friend, Fran, whose artwork you've already seen in this series. So Pete, if you could put the video on about now, we can start kind of looking into how, this kind of concept, or how it was for me. So just me and Hap thinking about things. And we're talking, I found out about criticism, self-criticism, first at the first kind of meeting we had as the Kurdish Solidarity Network in the UK. And one of the friends kind of started to explain it to me. And I was like, that's really interesting. That's really terrifying. But oh my God, this could really, really help us. Because a lot of the things that like I experienced in our movement, like radical left kind of UK based, I mean, I guess for me, England based movements, were that we built up a lot of trust between each other through doing actions together, through working together, through like being on the streets together, doing demonstrations, all of this kind of stuff. But when we built this trust like could become damaged, like, relationships that I built in the anarchist community in my hometown in Bristol are like some of the deepest relationships that I have. But I also saw in my community these relationships that people had built that were equally as deep, that were like damaged by not being able to talk about things, or like not solving things, or not like being able to speak about things. When my friends like started to tell me about criticism, self-criticism, I was like, oh, this actually sounds like it could be really interesting and useful to like start bringing this into our movements. And I'm not saying like, you know, let's just import all of the methods of the Kurdish freedom movement and use them in our spaces. Like, I don't think that that is like how this will like would really directly work. I think the thing that we need to do is like see how these things do work, think about them, and think about how they can be used in other ways in the struggle in this country, because they're obviously very successful in other places. Like Techmill itself, criticism, self-criticism is what I'm referring to when I talk about Techmill, is not like a new concept to like socialist and revolutionary movements. Like you see it coming up in like communist movements that have gone in other places in the world as well as in Kurdistan. So it's not like a new concept, and it's a concept that like is, in my opinion, like very useful in like unpicking tensions and things that go on as we progress through our time and our work together and our organizing together. But like Dilla was saying, like I think this concept of love is so, so important, and like this concept of Havalti and this concept of like building a deep bond together is really, really important. Because when we build a deep bond together, and you can see in the video I've included this, like obviously I'm talking about like 3 days in education in the little video, but like if you imagine this over like a longer period of time, if you imagine this over years of organizing with someone or months of organizing with someone, you build like these deep connections, and you are invested in them. And when you give someone a critique, it's like giving them an investment from yourself as well, to say, I will support you to help you with this. And like, I don't say like, you know, say I'm giving someone a critique. I don't say, I criticize you for this and then stop. Like what I do is I said, you know, you say the critique, and then after you say the critique, you also give like a perspective often of how you can change, of how like you can, of how this person might think about changing this behavior that is like, you know, that we don't see as like something inevitable in them. Like we don't see that it is inevitable that all of our male friends are patriarchal, even though all of our male friends have been socialized in patriarchy. We don't see it as inevitable that they can't dismantle this inside themselves. So we support them, and we support our friends, you know, also in the women's movement. I'm not just talking about like criticisms that you would make to male friends. So the process of Techmill, getting around to like the nitty gritty, is like coming together usually once a day maybe less often, maybe, well, not more often than once a day, but maybe less often, maybe every 3 days, we used to do when I was working in genealogy. And when you come into that space, you come and you've already thought about what has gone on in the last days. You can share reflections as part of a tech mill, but normally you sit down and the space is like, you know, for ideally you should try to make your critiques quite succinct and short in tech mill, but sometimes they go on for quite a long time. Our ones in genealogy tended to be a little long. And then in this space, you don't do other things while you're doing tech mill. You like are focusing on the tech mill. You're focusing on listening to the critiques. Often people will make notes during tech mill about critiques that are given to them or ones that are given to other people. Because also when we give critiques to other people, there's always something in that critique that also applies to yourself. Or like when you hear a critique, even between two people and you're not interacting with the critique at all, apart from listening, then that critique can apply to you and you can take something from it. And this is like very, very useful to like why the tech mill process is so useful and why we don't just do it in pairs, why we do it with the whole group. So we sit down and we do this and everybody tries to talk once and not longer. And at the end of the tech mill, we say, has anyone got anything else? And then we close the tech mill. And once we close the tech mill, people are like encouraged during the tech mill not to reply to critiques. And this is something very important. It's like, unless you feel like a critique is a real injustice to you, and there's something very unjust in the critique, you try not to reply to it. So you just take the critique and you sit with it and you try to think about it. No matter how hard it is and no matter how like difficult it is, and sometimes people make really deep criticisms of each other. If you've been working together for a long time, if you've been working together for like a year, you can imagine that you can make very deep critiques of your comrades. So when you are in these situations, like it's very important to just to try to take them and try to listen. So that's kind of basically tech mill. And then I wanted to talk a little bit about platforms. Ah, and this thing that Pete's helpfully reminded me. It's here. This is a picture that a friend made for us, which was like when I asked my friends to draw pictures of how they felt about tech mill when they first heard about it. And this is a drawing by a friend that's kind of about like the excitement, interest and anxiousness that they felt when they first started hearing about it. So I think this is, yeah, like it's really nice to have actually people's artwork. Not many people actually sent them. But this is like obviously a question of like why, and like I want to ask this to the chat as well, and like friends who are sitting and listening to this, to interact with the seminar and think about like, why are we afraid to be criticized? What makes us afraid of criticism? What made me afraid, like when I first heard about criticism, self-criticism, what made me afraid to receive criticism from my comrades? What makes you nervous? Or does it make you nervous? Does it not? Like, you know, this is an assumption that it makes people feel nervous. But I think it's very interesting to see people's reactions the first time you talk about it, because it's also like maybe a bit of a strange thing, like especially in Western culture and especially in the culture of England, where I've always been grown up and socialized, to like be able to openly say to someone, oh, I don't like when you do that. It's like very much anti, like very much like for me as an English person anyway, like it's very much like not ingrained in myself to be direct with people. So yeah, I think that is something that is going to be a challenge of like adopting practices like this into practice in England, at least that I see. And then I want to briefly talk about platforms and then I'm going to stop. Platforms are like essentially like a much larger tech mill, and sometimes they're used for accountability processes. So like Hazel asked this question earlier about how do we do accountability when we are abolitionists? And so sometimes we use platforms to go deeper into someone's personality to understand why certain behaviors come up and how they're coming up. And sometimes you have a platform at the end of a period of work or a period of education where you've been working with a lot of people for a long time. So for example, me and Irene Helene had one together in genealogy at the end of our education. And these platforms, like what happens is often you prepare a report at the beginning of your platform and you read out your report. And then afterwards, afterwards people will come back on your report and ask you questions related to your report. Your report is often about like your family life, like how you grew up. For the genealogy education that I was part of, like a lot of the questions were about like your relationship to women and like being a woman, which was quite difficult for me because I don't identify as like, I identify as they, them rather than she. So this is also like a, like an interesting topic to get into in also like anarchisty queer spaces. And so, yeah, that was our report was like a lot about that. But also if you were preparing a report for a platform, generally you would talk a lot about your family history, because Reba Appa also, like, one of the things that he thinks is really important that we analyze to analyze the person is to analyze the family history. So this would like be something that you would definitely go into in a report for a platform. And once you have read your report, like I said, friends can come back and they can ask you questions. And then once people have finished asking you questions, you would then like stop and you would receive critiques from everybody who is in the platform. And everybody doesn't have to give a critique, but like often many people do. So platforms can last like from like an hour, 45 minutes to like a day, depending on how many people in your platform are in your platform, how deep the platform is going, how deep the criticisms are going. And this is like obviously like a really overwhelming experience. It's really like, you know, for me, like I found it really, really intense in my platform in genealogy, because so many things that I was nervous about and like that I'm not comfortable with in my character got touched. But I also think it's really, really important to go into these things and like to touch them and to see them and to start like seeing the parts of ourselves which are like that we're not happy with, and start like working together with people that we love and that we have like a good basis of comradeship with, to develop ourselves and to develop these places and to go like to go into those places in ourselves to become the best people that we can be, because ultimately that's what we're aiming for when we give critiques to our comrades, is to make our comrades the best they can be and to make ourselves the best we can be by doing criticism, self-criticism. I'm going to shut up now and hand back over to Hazel, because I know that I probably went over with the time.
You didn't go over time. That was a great explanation. I'm also going to call back in Dila and Ari and Helene as well into the conversation. So I don't know if there's any points that either of you wanted to add on to this, like maybe your own experiences with platform, for example. I think actually a lot of people have heard about Techmill and this concept of criticism and self-criticism, especially because that a lot of other movements have used. But I think this concept of platform also is something quite, yeah, I think it's more unusual for this context that we're in the sort of left of England or the UK.
Hebal Arin, do you want to respond or?
Yeah. You're muted.
Okay, here. I think Hebal Arin explained the concept of platform quite well, and I think it's something that you mostly understand with the, through the practice. But I got something that I think is really interesting is about the afraid of being criticized. And I think this is also like a part of our European mentality, where we have like a kind of models that what should be good and desirable and lovely. And these models, if we don't reach them, is because we are not enough, or we are not putting enough effort. So we must to be perfect. And when you have the command to be perfect, of course, any critic that anyone can do on you is going to hurt you. But I also think this is a part, like another point that is important, is like the culture of criticizing Europe. I don't know how is the institutional politics in UK, but in Spain, it's like a really bloody circus. So politicians, they are criticizing each other and attacking each other, trying to harm as much as they can, not trying to really propose something that can improve the situation. So if our culture in European culture of criticism is to attack each other, I think it's really normal that we are afraid to being criticized. But what I learned from the culture of criticism and self-critic in the movement, and for me is what gave me strength to try to practice this and try to develop it, is that it is a collective and individual responsibility. It is a practice that bases on the desire to support each other, to improve as individuals and a group, and that requires self-awareness and confidence in the people that we are surrounding, that they can change and they want to change. And criticism is not just to give the critic. It's not a moment. It's like a standard process where you have a reflection, and after you give the criticize, in which way do you give, and where, how, with purpose, and after, mostly how collectively we are going to apply this critic to help the comrade to develop themselves. So I think it's also a change of mentality. It's not only it's more difficult than just I'm really glad the people criticize me. It's also how and where and with which purpose we are doing this critic. And yeah, I don't know if you want to develop something else.
I think both of you have explained these things very well. I think it's always when we are afraid of a critique by somebody, we are in a way also afraid of overcoming obstacles. And I think this is something related to how, especially it's a very gendered thing, because women are expected to do a lot of work in a very exploitative, sacrificial kind of way. And then, or this also happens when men, you know, traditionally being the ones who bring the money back home, that they then dismiss any criticism, because I do so much for you, how can you say this to me, right? So this sometimes happens also in activist circles, where we get burnouts because we think we're doing a lot, we're doing everything, and that means we should be not be able to be criticized. So just because I am a Kurdish woman does not mean I am radical or revolutionary as such, or just because somebody is, as Mustafa Sarıkaya was saying, just because you claim to be a socialist doesn't mean you actually live like one. It doesn't mean that because you come from the working class that you're actually revolutionary. How can you take an identity and revolutionize yourself and overcome also the things that prevent you from becoming a force of social transformation? I think these things are very important, and they're very relevant to things when we speak about abolition, we speak about new forms of accountability, when we speak about how can we become a force that is supportive and that is actually also fun. I mean, it's also all about bringing joy to the revolutionary process. It's not about alienating each other. It's not about a kind of saying, you do this wrong, you do this wrong, you're a bad person. We actually overcome the idea that people are bad or inherently kind of obstacles by saying, no, actually you can change and I will help you. And here is a solution. And we can find a collective solution to this. So I think, again, this comes down to the idea of, yeah, you really need to believe that a person can change. Even if that person is really awful, it's of course a lot of work, you know, and it shouldn't be always the burden of other people to help somebody. This is why we say that person also needs to be able to see that in themselves. But for example, the co-presidency system, which sometimes gets really misunderstood by people as like just like a symbolic representation of gender equality, actually it is also a criticism of a male leadership type, right? The woman who is the co-leader in that position, she is the constant criticism of a male-dominated form of, because she represents the women's collective willpower there, she also struggles against somebody in her own movement. So we also have co-presidency, for example, as a form of accountability and resistance and internal democratization. So I think everything we speak about comes also down to having a more feminist idea of revolution, right? So in the past, revolutionaries or revolutions thought about social change has to come from the top, come from the state, come from state socialism, come from somebody, come from the party. But we're trying to braid through confederal organizing, through autonomies, through relating struggles, by finding common struggles, common vocabularies. We try to create a revolutionary project from below, actually, by organizing in the here and now, and by having principles like women's autonomy to be the guarantee. Because not every revolution is necessarily good. Not every social change is necessarily good. How can we fight for freedom? And we say our guarantee, for example, is the women's revolution. And the women's revolution is qualitatively very different from state-centric revolutions, which give you orders from the top. We find ways of justice seeking, of meaning giving, of new friendships, of new family. Democratic family, for example, is one of the things that is discussed in the women's movement. So these are all things, I think, concepts also that we as the women's movement especially want to share with others. But above all, it's all about always remembering that the Kurdish society, I grew up in the Kurdish freedom movement, and I can say even in my own short lifetime, we have seen so many changes. We see how people speak differently to each other in our community centers, in our cultural centers. The fact that violence against women is no longer tolerated is the fact that people in our communities know now that the women's collective will must be respected as a principle in our organizing culture. Empowers us. So not every woman has to become a revolutionary, not every woman has to become an activist, but every single woman in our community now knows that the women's movement has her back. And that, of course, changes social relations. So I think these are some of the things that people can learn from the Kurdish movement. And we're also, of course, constantly learning from others. And I think internationalist organizing, again, has brought many things that we need to criticize about ourselves in Kurdish communities, for example.
I would also just chip in, just as like a basis for this kind of ideology, like when we're talking about like changing men as well, I would just give a quick shout out to Bell Hooks's book. And I know this, like every white activist who references Bell Hooks, but it is an amazing book called The Will to Change, and it's really worth reading. And it's one of the books that we read in genealogy, like alongside learning about practices of tech mill and criticism, self-criticism. And it's like quite interesting to read it alongside like these kind of discussions that we're having in this seminar today, because it's going along with a similar idea to what has been like to what we're kind of bringing up in this seminar. And it's very, very interesting to like start looking into, and it's very interesting to read her perspectives on it and kind of like start to intersect them with these kind of discussions.
Yeah, I also wanted to say, especially in response to what Dilla was saying, I think that a lot of these mechanisms and tools and like the ways of relating to each other, it's also somehow really tied into this concept of individualism and how like exhausting things are under neoliberalism and in a really like individualist society. How if somebody does criticize you and maybe it's really difficult, or maybe not even criticizing, but you know, just having like conflict, it's a very exhausting thing if you don't feel like anyone else has your back, because there's essentially no collective culture or group that is actually there for you. I mean, okay, some people have families and stuff like this, but also not everyone has a supportive family or a supportive group of friends. And even that, it's like always this risk that it can just break down. And somehow there's this, yeah, like continuous, not only like exclusion from other people, but like self-exclusion. Like people can drop out of movements, or people can drop out of friendship groups, or people can like move from city to city for like jobs and stuff like this. And somehow people, I don't know, almost like become lost, like as just individuals. And I think that these tools can also be a way to kind of try and like solidify trust and like solidify a way of being able to hold each other together when like we're always going to be struggling for, well, survival in like different ways against capitalism. So in the next section, we wanted to address some of the questions. So the first one, I don't know who wants to answer it. It's up to you guys. But how does politics as subculture, as identity, often in opposition to the majority, mean for our action? My sense is seeing ourselves, selves or community as activist hero and society as target, and that this prevents real connection and is a barrier to transformation.
I can kick that one off, I guess. I think, yeah, this is like the nail on the head. No, it's like the biggest issue that we have, I think, in my case, like the predominantly anarchist movements that I've worked in, is that we kind of seem to set ourselves up in opposition to society often. Like it's maybe not intentional, and like maybe not, or like at least not always intentional, but I think like quite often when we set ourselves up in this like oppositional position, or when we set ourselves up as like inaccessible to society. So there's this like big thing that I like learned about in Rojava also, where we're talking about like ethics and aesthetics, and we're talking about like how like, and I'm not going to explain this well, so probably someone else is going to have to jump in, but like how even like the look of like people who are perceived as political is often like off-putting to the society, or often like makes us look different or makes us seem different to society, and like makes us like already separated. And then alongside that, we have like obviously like our subcultural bubble, where we're often like, you know, like our spaces where we feel safe and we feel okay to talk to everyone, and like they end up quite often just being echo chambers, like where you're hearing the same thing of, you know, your opinions essentially, or your opinions slightly modified, being reflected back at you. And whilst that's very nice, and like whilst it's like very pleasant to have your opinions reflected back at you, it doesn't really develop like our methods of talking to society. It doesn't really develop our community. Like, of course it develops like our community of our subculture, of our like small radical left subculture, but it doesn't go away to, it doesn't take that extra step of stepping into spaces that we are uncomfortable, which is really necessary for us to do, is to step into spaces where like we are uncomfortable, and be the people who listen, and be the people who are not always talking and not always saying this is my politics and everybody should fall in line with my politics, but be listening to other people and hearing who the people are that we can walk with, and who we can organize with, and who we share political perspectives with, and how we then as a community can step forward together. Because the point is not to like, you know, if you imagine it as a race, if we imagine revolution as a race, which is silly because it's also competitive, but bear with me on the metaphor, then we don't want like one group like running ahead who are already over the finish line, while we've got this other group back here who barely got off the starting line and like haven't had the opportunities that we have had, who are at the finish line, to get off the starting line. Like, there is no point taking steps for a small amount of people when we're not taking a step that's in favor of the general society or the community. Like, you know, it's the same with the individual, the relationship between the individual and the collective. Like, there's no point in a collective having one individual who can only do something, because then you just, when that individual's not there, you're kind of, you know, kind of left hanging. So what you need to do is take a collective step together. And as we walk this path, we want to like walk in step with other movements, with other people, with other ways of thinking that can go with ours and that are taking a revolutionary approach. And I think this is really important to start like coming out of this. Dilara and Ari, sorry.
I think just quickly on that, Sakine Jansız, who's one of the founders of the Kurdish Freedom Movement and of the women's movement as well, she wrote in her autobiography where she explains the development of the movement and how it first got in touch with communities and in Kurdistan, where people had sometimes no concept of a Kurdistan as such. So organizing in a landscape where there was a lot of revolutionary organizing, but also a lot of sectarianism on the left, she has a paragraph where she describes how she was really put off by some of the behaviors on the left, because they didn't seem attractive. Because they didn't seem attractive to the people. Actually, many people in the rural communities were put off by the lifestyle of the revolutionaries, because they didn't look like they were happy. Their behavior, their lifestyle didn't attract people. So of course, different things attract different people, but the point she was trying to make is, in order to be a revolutionary, you have to be what we can call a forerunner, like somebody who is actually walking with the people, as also Hevalarin was saying, walking with the people, but the Kurdish word for leadership that somebody explained in the chat as well, reber, is actually, it has to do with somebody who walks the way because they know something about how to walk, but they walk together with the people. So in this sense, being revolutionary also means beautifying life for the communities. It's not about alienating or antagonizing yourself from the society. And this is, again, one of the things that we criticize about some social movements and some feminist movements, is if you really want to change society, you cannot distance yourself from it. But it does not mean that you have to accept everything in that society. It does not mean you have to go and play by the rules of conservatives or elites or whatever in order to, because that's what we mean when we say we need to change who is society, who gets to define who society is. And for that, if the youth and the women can play a leading role, we believe that it will also lead to different, a more democratic form of leadership, a different way of accountability, which is why the relationship between the women's movement and the general movement is similar to the individual and society as well in that way.
Maybe I could like also to add a little thing about this. I think is also about the way we think, no? Like we have as a basis that everyone can think whatever they want, and because democracy is this, no? It's to respect ideas of each other. But when we put in practice this, we really don't accept the diversity of ideas. And this also make like that we been split in a really little groups that really have no any strength to go against the powers that we are fighting against, no? So, and I think it's also really interesting because it's expressing that it is an expression in the Kurdish movement. I really like it. It is if a person is so deep in the mat, but only one hair come out of this mat, we must grab this person and help them out. And this thing is really interesting. Is the saying expressing the hope that all people have and can play a role in the struggle. Then even we have different opinions and even we have, of course, red lines, there is always a way to reach certain agreement and push forward collective struggle. But and even more deep, and I think even more important is also about taking responsibility, you know, is knowing that one of our tasks is to try to include more people in the struggle every day. And it is, of course, a difficult task, but at the same time, it's the only way that we can really become a force that can fight against the established power. So it's also about what would we want with this, with our struggle, for what we are struggling, no? And I think this is a question that we should really make it to every one of us. Thank you.
So the next question, well, there's a few questions actually around Techville that I'll combine from Facebook. So did someone ever get really angry after receiving criticism? And also somebody asked, is Techville confined to a time which you set aside for it, or can you do it at any point in the day? Which has also been answered in the chat, so, but in like very briefly. So if somebody wants to kind of respond to these.
I would like to respond to the first one, like if someone really can be angry to being criticized, because I think we suppose that the critic that we receive, they are stuff that maybe we consider it that they are not good in ourselves, but we didn't spread it in loud voice. But sometimes we have been, or we can be criticized with things that we think that are good, that and this is also a confrontation of ideas. And sometimes we don't have the strength to, like a one of the like a part of the method of critic and self-critic is to respect and listen even the opinions that are not like our opinions, to think that every friend that is giving a critic to us is because they love each other, and we should listen and respect their opinion even if it's not our opinion. So it's not about the questions or the stuff that we know that they are wrong, but more also about the question of the things that maybe we didn't even think in, or the things that we think that they are right, but at the end, maybe they can be improved, no? That's it.
Yeah, I really agree with Irene on that. Like, there are definitely times where I've had criticisms and they've hurt, like, because it's been something that I feel sensitive about already, or like I feel some kind of like thing that is a bit essential to my like being as me, and like sometimes I've been like, oh okay, or like maybe like, oh, that was expressed in a way that was like not whatever, like not perfect. But we also have to remember that our comrades are like also fallible human beings who are not perfect and who are not always going to express criticisms in like 100% the perfectest, like the most perfect way that they can. So there's also that, and there's also like, you know, the reaction to feeling hurt is sometimes to feel a bit cross and to feel a bit like, oh well, you know, I'm a bit grumpy about that. But then to also to try to see these things in ourselves and try to see, like, when you do Techville quite often, you also start to see the patterns that you have when receiving criticism. Like often when I receive criticism, I feel quite anxious, and I have like a lot of the feelings that I have when I'm anxious about something. But, and like those feelings can sometimes translate into like anger or sadness or like different emotions. But to, the most important thing is to try to take them away and to try not to respond and try not to like immediately react with the gut instinct emotional reaction that you might have.
I think it's important to stress that after these kinds of things, usually people do fun activities together as well, either dance or sing together, just to kind of bond again and to know that if I criticize somebody, I also, it's a responsibility actually, because then I say, I will help you. You can't just put something out there and then withdraw from any responsibility. And also another thing that is important to say is that in a take me, when somebody has been criticized on something, you don't repeat it again and you don't make a big deal about it afterwards as well. You give that person time to reflect and you support them also emotionally. And that again comes down to creating an atmosphere where people know, yes, I have just said this to you, but that's not because I don't think, because I think you're a bad person. It's actually, we are now going to cook something together or do some activity together. So just so people understand that it's not a totally confrontive, but of course people get angry, but there are ways to create an environment where reflection and not reaction is possible.
So there's another question as well on TechMail. Which is, self-criticism is great to develop oneself when there's an atmosphere of mutual trust and respect. It's good to develop ourselves and activism. But what do you do when someone who has a large ego and power uses self-criticism and criticism as a method to simply control others?
Maybe I can give a short reflection about this. I think criticism and self-critic can be used as an informal power relationship. How to say it? I mean, I think it's more difficult when you have a method, like a formal method, that can be misused to attack someone. Mostly if the collective know what are the rules of this method and for what they are for, no? I think, in fact, in the informal collective or relationship where they are not methods, where they are simply power informal relationship, are more complicated or more easy, in fact, to use like a criticism or hierarchical positions inside the groups of the movements. So I think methods is also a question of protecting of the group, no? Like, I mean, if you as a group know what are the rules or what are the basis of the movement, of the ideology, is always more difficult that someone can jump over it. Like they would need like a fear or like a authoritarian control. And I think this is not the basis of what we are talking about, no? So I don't know if I've been clear with my English. That's it.
Dila, do you wanna? Yeah, I think I agree with Irene on this. I think it's like very, like in my experience in Rojava with tech mills, like I think it is very hard for people to manipulate them in a way that creates like the informal hierarchies and power structures that you see often, or like that we often create in the radical left here. Like, you know, like quite often you find there are men particularly who have like quite a lot of informal power in our struggles, or like people who can do a certain thing who have like quite a lot of informal power. But because of the methods of TechMill that I've seen, like the whole group is responsible and you have community responsibility for the processes that go on in the space where you're living or working or the group that you're working within. So because everybody has responsibility to it, everybody has responsibility to dismantle informal hierarchy as well, because that's the basis that, you know, like if you're working, if you're doing TechMill from a revolutionary perspective, then you also theoretically are working for like a non-hierarchical world. So then it's up to us, it's our responsibility individually to challenge individuals who are like maybe subvert or like trying to subvert the use of something like TechMill or platforms or criticism, self-criticism as a method generally. And if that isn't happening, then, I mean, in Rojava there are methods to deal with these kind of things, but this is something that, again, like here, when we use these methods, we have to think about, because if these methods do end up being used badly or abused because we don't understand them properly, or we're not using them in the context that they're, like, you know, thought about to be used in the Kurdish movement, or like the, in the place where we're taking them from, then we need to also have checks and balances on those communes who are using it, or like the collectives of groups who are using it, and they need to have other places they can go if it's not working as a means to resolve things. And I think this is like where we start getting into the need for like overarching, like, revolutionary groups in, like, in my context, England, who, like, where you don't just have like your anti-fascist group over here, your anti-arms trade group over here, and everybody's all spread out in different places. Like, having a group that works, like, collectively towards revolution with a long-term perspective is really, really necessary, like, to start, and it's necessary for us to start thinking about these things when we start using these these methods of the movement, because these methods are connected to that long-term perspective, and they're connected to having a revolutionary outlook which, like, goes off into the future. And when we have these outlooks, we can build these structures that make it possible to have accountability from the smallest level to the, you know, to a much, much wider group of people. I don't know if that makes sense. Dilad, you want to come back as well?
We've actually run out of time for questions, so yeah, we might have to, if we respond to questions later on after the seminars, then you can have a look at the comments, but some might have to remain unanswered. But there were questions about how women can develop themselves and free themselves without getting involved directly in politics, and like how to engage politically without sort of going really deep into like concepts and really like intellectualized concepts. And then there was also a question about new trends in family structures in non-monogamous relationships. But yeah, we really have run out of time, so sorry about that. So in the final minutes, we're going to do a tech mill. But I just also wanted to say that this is not going to be a normal tech mill, because we wouldn't normally do it on Zoom in front of 60, how many is that? 66 like people, and however many people on Facebook, it's quite strange. Usually it would be in a really trusted environment, and also people would have time to reflect throughout the day. So we're doing this directly after the actual session, which means that we haven't had any time to reflect on it as well. Yeah, and we did also discuss opening it up to everyone in the call, but then we decided not to because the dynamic is very different. People act quite differently when they're behind a computer screen than when it's your comrades in your group. But we do actually have a feedback form, so please do send us feedback and criticism if you want to. It'd be really helpful, and we have been looking at the criticism and feedback from previous sessions when people have sent us the feedback. And yeah, people get an email for that, or you can also just message Kurdistan Solidarity Network on Facebook if you don't have the form. So yeah. So the first person, oh, also just to quickly say, there was a few other people who have been working on this session who weren't speaking today as well. So we're doing it with six of us. And the first person who's gonna go first is Joe.
Hi everybody. Yeah, it's somewhat ironic given the criticism I'm gonna give. So I'm gonna give a self-criticism. So I was monitoring the chat, by the way. So if I missed a question to be fed back to the speaker, then I'm sorry about that. But my criticism is that I didn't take a role as a speaker today because I have a bit of a fear of cameras and of being seen. Especially, I know this is going out onto a big, massive live streaming on Facebook. So I have some work to do on that in order to participate better in future sessions.
So Pete.
Hello everyone. Yeah, I've been behind the scenes as well. So my self-criticism is that basically on the build-up to the seminar, I kind of got into this bad habit of getting anxious and kind of nervous about it. And so I end up kind of blotting out the kind of what's causing a problem. And so that made me kind of disconnect and unresponsive to group messages and things like that. And so, yeah, that's my self-criticism. And also just for what's been going on now, I think we've had some internal chat going on whilst we've been doing this as well. And I think I put in some confusing contributions. So yeah, that's me.
Tom?
All right, so my self-criticism. So I've been monitoring the Facebook chat. My self-criticism would be about the lighting behind me, because it's really not easy to see me, so sorry about that. Another self-criticism would be that I'm very new to using Facebook, and I haven't got my head around some of the technology. And also, we had a troll on the Facebook group, and we hadn't decided on a strategy for how to deal with people who came to be disruptive. So we should have talked about those things beforehand, and you know, me in particular, because I was doing that role with another comrade. And no self-criticism for others.
Irene?
So I have a self-criticism that I was late to the Zoom call because I didn't set up my technology on time and I was running, and that is extremely poor time management. I have a bit of a criticism about the process and the run up to the seminar, that sometimes we were a little bit slow to respond on the chat, on the Signal group that we have. To things that were being put in which were necessary to the organization of the seminar. So sometimes it felt a bit like when I put things in and people didn't respond, I felt a bit alone in being worried about what we were gonna do if something was needed. Like, yeah, I hope that's clear. If you need clarification, do so.
Lilla?
I have criticism and self-criticism. I think the technical test that we did beforehand, I think we could have been a bit more concise. It was a bit long and time consuming. So next time we can be a bit quicker. But at the same time, I want to criticize myself for that, because I noticed I've been relying on other people's technical abilities, and I haven't actually educated myself enough on Zoom to be able to also take up some of these responsibilities. So that's something I want to change. And also, I think I spoke more than I had planned in the beginning, and I think I repeated myself a few times. And also, I think I repeated the points that the other friends have made. So that's something I wanted to criticize about myself.
Thank you. So my self-criticism is that I was not very good with timing. We already agreed that I would cut people off if they were going over time, and I didn't do it because I felt a bit too anxious to do it. And also, I didn't want to cut Dilara off because I like listening to you speak. So you did go over time, but actually it was my job as a facilitator to do that. And also another self-critic for not completing the intro that actually I'd prepared in my mind. Because I also felt quite anxious, and there was many offers from the comrades to actually discuss the meeting, and I didn't do it. So I could have been more prepared, but I did not. But I don't have any criticisms for others. Apart from, yeah, there was some already mentioned about responding to messages. So yeah, that's everything. So when Tekmil is over, people say, how about Khosh? And then people respond. And this is basically like saying good work. So yeah, how about Khosh?
Sabe!
Are they?
Okay, thanks. Okay, so also just before everyone goes and before we have music, there's a couple of other campaigns that we wanted to shout out. There's next week's session, it's the last session of these seminars, which is going to be at the same time, 7:30, and it's going to be What's Next for Social Movements in the UK. It's going to be on the 15th of June, so same time, same day. And also on June the 11th at 6 p.m. UK time, BST, there's an event organised by the Kurdish Women's Movement on the politics of prisons, which is together with feminist activists from Black Lives Matter US, the Philippines, Palestine, Colombia and Kurdistan. So there isn't a post for this yet, but it will be publicised really soon. So yeah, we'll share it as KSN, so keep your eyes out for that. And then finally, there's also the Donate to Water for Rojava fundraising campaign, which is basically a campaign to raise £100,000 to support women's cooperatives and vital water projects in northeast Syria. So yeah, please check out these as well. And yeah, thanks everyone for participating and also for giving us some good questions. I also, the thing that I actually missed out of the intro is about how incredible this moment in history is with the US and the uprising, and that is only because of all of the generations of struggle that have come before that this moment has been possible, and that it will also be the generations after us that will continue that struggle, and that this is also worldwide. So I just wanted to express that before we finish with a song.
Merhaba jwara ji Bakurê Kurdistanê ji Amedê slav û hezkirin ji bo hemûyan.
He says greetings to everybody from northern Kurdistan, from Ahmed. Greetings and love to you all. It's true that each one of us is in a different part of the world at the moment. Still, there are many ways in which we connect to each other. For us, it's the women's struggle, a freedom struggle that grows and flourishes with the colors and voices of women. That's why I salute our struggle and resistance once again. I wanted to join you live today so that we see each other, get to know and feel each other, but unfortunately, I'm going to be traveling when you have your event. That's why I'm joining you with this video. I actually had a little accident yesterday. I have some small wounds around my eyes, but my hands and fingers are hurting especially. It means I will struggle a little bit when I play, but still I will contribute with one or two songs. I won't speak for much more with the belief that the women's struggle will change the world. I once again send you kisses, hugs, and greetings, and wish you success in your work.
should be.